So in our text, as today, it's Thursday evening, if you note in the Gospel, John tells us that it is before the Feast of Passover, although the other Gospels tell us that the apostles or the disciples were sent ahead of Jesus to prepare the upper room where they're meeting for the Passover feast. So you might wonder why that is. We've talked about that before in our series on Mark. At this time in the history of Israel, at this time in the history of Judea, there were actually two Passover feasts. One that would take place on the evening before Nisan 14, and one on Nisan 14 itself. And that's because there was a dispute about the lunar calendar. And so the temple made accommodation and just decided to slaughter Passover lambs on the on Nisan 13 and Nisan 14 just to be safe. And what that did, if you missed this sermon in Mark, you can go back and check it out. I'm just giving you a brief summary here. And so what that did is it allowed Jesus to both celebrate Passover and then the next day be the Passover lamb. And that's what we have here. It's this beginning of this Passover feast. It's Thursday night. And Jesus and the 12 are gathering in a large upper room. And John tells us there that he knows the hour has come. He knows he's going to the Father. We're told that having loved his own in the world, he now loves them to the end. Now, in your text, you'll notice that John uses the past tense. But what he's doing there is he's summarizing everything that happens from chapter 13 all the way to chapter 20. Jesus is loving his own in the world. He's loved them before, and now he's going to love them to the end. Now, the word there for end is telos, and that's not a time reference. That's not John saying that Jesus loved them to the last breath, the last moment. That instead is a word that communicates the concept of consummation or fulfillment or perfection. Jesus, John's saying, loves them to the perfection, to the fulfillment, to the completion of love. Now, the word there for love, as you probably guessed, is agape. If you've been at Christian Ed, you know that we've defined this word agape as a pouring of oneself out for the good of another, an active self-giving for the good of another. We've said three things about it: that it doesn't depend on emotion. You can agape someone whether or not you feel love for them. Whether you feel affection for them, it doesn't matter. Agape is not dependent on your feelings. Second, we've said that it's not a need-based action. The purpose of agape is not to capture the other's affection. You don't pour out yourself for someone so that you'll get them to reciprocate in some way. And that leads to the third characteristic of agape, in that it's not reciprocal. It doesn't depend on the other's response. It doesn't matter whether the person loves you back. Now, tonight we're going to see all of those characteristics of agape perfected, consummated, fulfilled. Jesus, his agape, is the foundation and the shape of all Christian relationships. This is the model for it, the basis for it. This is what Christian relationships ought to look like. We say that when you get married, you don't, thank goodness, promise to be in love until death. That would be a vow that no one could make. Our understanding of being in love has to do with the way you feel. No two people vow or can vow to be in love until death. Instead, what they do is they vow to agape till death. They also don't make that promise to each other. They make that promise to God. They promise God that they will agape the other person until death. The purpose of marriage is to reflect to the world the love that God in Jesus Christ makes manifest here in chapter 13. Marriage is about Jesus and his church. And the truth is, Jesus did not fall for you. He didn't fall in love with you. It wasn't your brilliant life skills, your virtues, your musical abilities that caused Jesus to pick you, choose you, decide to love you. One look at the 12 will show you that. Jesus simply agapes his church to the end. And there's nothing about the church that causes him to do that. Now, you'll notice in verse 2 there, text, that during supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. The language there might lead to some confusion. The devil, we're told, had already put it into Judas's heart to betray Jesus. So you might get the impression that Judas is just kind of sitting there innocently, minding his own business, and suddenly Satan sneaks in, unaware, and plants this idea of betrayal in Judas's heart. Well, we know that's not the case. James tells us very clearly in James chapter 1, verses 14 through 15, each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire gives birth to sin, which brings forth death. Sin is not Satan's, not something that Satan plants in you. Satan merely sets what he knows you want before your eyes. Judas, by the time we get to John chapter 13, is already Jesus' enemy. Satan has only opened a door to act out the enmity that Judas already has for Jesus. We've asked several times during our series on Mark, what happened to Judas? Why did Judas become a traitor? We can't be sure. The typical first century Jew waits for God's Messiah to destroy the Romans and exalt Israel. The typical first century Jew sees himself and all law-keeping Jews as a light in the dark world. But we've also seen that Jesus, throughout his ministry, has far more to say about Israel's sin than Rome's oppression. And we've seen over and over again that Jesus places law-keeping Jews on par with the wicked Gentiles. His gospel, preached throughout Israel, is all are guilty. All must repent and surrender to me. And then Jesus says to all of his disciples, prepare to die, not to conquer. Take up your cross, deny yourself, trust me. So you can see why, and we've seen why, many people have rejected him throughout his ministry. And at some point, Judas became one of those people. So why does he stay? Why does Judas stay among the 12, having rejected Jesus? Well, we might ask the same question. Why do people stay in church while rejecting the gospel? It happens in every church. It happens in every congregation. Many reasons for that, perhaps. Now, with Judas, we do have some insight. He's wasted several years of his life on a man that he believed would be the Messiah and on a man who he believed would bring him glory and success. And he's not leaving empty-handed. That's for sure. We know that he's been pilfering from the money bag. And since he's the one who's the treasurer, when Jesus is arrested. When the disciples are arrested, he probably figures that he'll have the entire money back. He's the one left holding it. And of course, there's the 30 pieces of silver that he's already negotiated for. He's just waiting for the right time. And as they gather, he is waiting for an opportunity to leave. We also know that Jesus knows Judas. Way back in John chapter 6, Jesus preaches a sermon. One of the best sermons he's ever preached to a crowd of 20,000 people, and they all leave afterwards, and they stop being his disciples after that because he said, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood to be my disciple. They all leave. The 12 remain behind, and Jesus says in a kind of a burst of affection, did I not choose you? And then he says, and yet one of you is the devil. And then John tells us right there that Jesus spoke of Judas. Jesus has known that Judas is his betrayer all along. And Jesus knows what Judas will do tonight. He knows that Judas will not change his mind. He knows that Judas's heart is hard. Keep that in mind as we see what Jesus does here. That's not all Jesus knows. In verse 3, we're told, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he'd come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. This also is not new knowledge. 12 years old. Who's read Luke chapter 2, the story of Jesus when he's 12 years old? His family takes him to Jerusalem for a great feast. It's a busy time. They all load the wagons back up after the feast, and they take off, and then Mary's wondering, I forgot something. And then she looks around, and it turns out that she forgot Jesus. And so did Joseph. They run back. I'm not sure if Joseph's even mentioned there. He may already be deceased. But they run back to Jerusalem, look all over the place. They finally find him in the temple. And Mary is angry, seems like anyway, in the text. What? Why? How could you do this to us? How could you stay gone for so long? Or why didn't you come with us when we left? And Jesus says, didn't you know I must be in my Father's house? Jesus never went through an aha moment where he suddenly figured out who he was. Jesus never doubts his identity. He knows always that he is his Father's son. Now, the text is odd here because why would John bring that up now? John's told us about Judas's being enticed into his betrayal. It was already in his heart. Why must John now tell us that Jesus knows that he's from the Father and he's going to the Father? What bearing does that have on our account? In our marriage counseling sessions, one of the first things that we try to get across to young couples is this: your husband or your wife cannot fulfill you. He or she cannot complete you, as the Hallmark card says, or the movie thing says. You're not finding someone to make you a whole person. If that's why you're getting married, don't get married. Don't make another person bear that weight. That weight's an impossible weight to bear. And if you do see the person in your life you're going to marry, if you see that person as the one who will complete you or fulfill you or make your life whole, that will make agape-ing that person impossible. Utterly impossible. Here's why. You'll serve that person, but you'll need that person to serve you back. You'll give to that person, you'll pour out your affection for that person, but you'll need that person to return it back to you. You'll give, but you'll give to evoke and compel the proper response. And as we've seen, that's not agape. And if your love for this person, if your affection for this person, if your service for this person, if your giving of yourself to this person isn't returned in kind, you're crushed or you're embittered or you're resentful. Because what you've done is you've set that person in a place that only God can occupy. And you've given that person weight to bear that only God can bear. Only Jesus can fulfill you. He can bear that weight. Now here's the deal. If he does, if he is the one who you have in your life as the one you expect to fulfill you, complete you, make you whole, if he does that, then what that means is that your husband or your wife, and this doesn't just apply to marriage, this applies to every relationship in your life, then your husband, your wife, your friend, whoever, can hurt you deeply, but they can never destroy you. You have somewhere to go with the pain and the anger and the resentment. You have someone who's always with you and for you. And what that will mean is that even though your friend or your husband or your wife or your spouse, whoever, does not return your affection or doesn't give you exactly what you give them, or there's not reciprocity in your relationship, you can keep your promise to God to agape that person. Because it doesn't depend on how that person acts toward you. Now, this is why I think John brings this statement up, that Jesus knows where he's come from and he knows where he's going. Jesus, in his humanity, is fully and completely satisfied, comforted, and fulfilled in his Father. He's come from his Father. He's going to his Father. And so what that means is he can agape his church. He can agape Peter and James and John and the rest. He can agape even Judas to the end, to the perfection of agape, to the completion and consummation of agape. And we're going to see him begin to do that now. People in the first century in Jerusalem, the style of footwear were sandals. People wore sandals with open tops. Streets of Jerusalem, as the streets of any ancient city, would be filthy. People just threw their stuff out in the street, and you had to watch out for it when you're walking around. So when you'd entered a house, normally you would have your feet washed. But this would be especially true for formal meals, because during a formal meal, Jews would sit in a U-shaped, or around a U-shaped low table, and they would recline, and they would recline in such a way their feet were kind of behind them, and their heads were toward the table. And what that would mean is that feet and faces, nose and toes, are very close together. So you would want to have your feet washed. Now, it's a nasty job. That's why usually servants would do it, or children would do it, or women would do it. Those were the good old days. We don't have those days anymore, but those were the good old days. They would do it. Not anymore. Servants, children, or women. We've learned, however, that Jesus has intended always to spend this final Passover with just the 12. Just the 12. So there are no servants or children or women in the room. Now, at this point, a younger disciple, one of the younger ones, John, maybe, ought to step up and say, well, I'll wash the feet. Or they could just take turns and wash each other's feet. There's lots of options out of this problem. But it's not been done. That Jesus gets up and begins to do it tells us that it's not been done. And that tells us there's a problem. The first century reader would ask immediately, why haven't the feet been washed? And we're told why they haven't been washed, actually, in Luke chapter 22, verse 24. Because there we're told, during this supper, a dispute also arose among them. Can you guess, just knowing the history of the disciples, what this dispute might have been about? Anyone? All right, Ray, yes, a dispute arose among them regarding which of them was the greatest. Now, that just tells you they don't have any idea what is about to happen, even though Jesus has told them many times what's about to happen. A dispute arose about which of them was the greatest. They've been arguing about this since Galilee. Now, the stakes are high. Because if they, one good thing about them is they do believe that Jesus is the Messiah. But they believe the Messiah is not going to die. They believe the Messiah is going to reign over not just Jerusalem, not just Israel, but the world. And so the greatest of the 12 will be the second greatest man in all the world. So the stakes are high. Now, what that would mean is that to voluntarily say, hey, you know what, guys, I'll wash your feet, is to lose the argument, is to say, I'm not the greatest among you. And so there they are. They're all kind of just waiting around. No one's washed their feet. No one really wants to sit down yet, because if you sit down, you're next to someone's dirty, nasty feet. So they're just, you can imagine, kind of standing there, waiting. And then verse 4 and 5, he, Jesus, laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel that was wrapped around him. This act is the epitome of Jesus' purpose and his ministry. Let me confess something to you that you might know. Hopefully you don't think this, but I would like to be God. I would. I don't think I say that consciously to myself a lot. I don't think, wow, I really would like to rule over the world. But the reason I know that I want to be God is because I want you to be thinking about me a lot. If you don't notice me, this is, I don't think I'm alone in this. Have you ever noticed human beings tend to think that other people are thinking about them more than they actually do? Well, I kind of want you to think about me a lot and not think bad things about me. I want you to think good things about me a lot. I want you to seek to do your best to please me. I do. I would like that. I want you to admire me. Now, when for some reason you don't fulfill those desires that I have, I'm sad, or I'm resentful, or I'm bitter. That's all because, like Adam, I want to be God. A little God. Well, actually a big God, but I can deal with little God. That's fine. And so do you. That's the human problem. It's been the human problem since the garden. To cure us, to fix this problem, God became us. Think back to the garden. Adam sits by and watches as Eve struggles with the serpent, who has offered her the fruit of power, autonomy, glory, personal fulfillment. Adam just sits by and he's thinking to himself, well, you know, that fruit looks kind of good too. And he takes some of it. In contrast to that, the Son, in our text today, stands up, wraps himself in a towel, takes a basin, and wipes the grime off his church's feet. Instead of grasping for the fruit of power and glory, instead of taking what is his, he pulls his hand back and he ministers to his church. This is not mere example. I mean, Jesus does say later on that what he has done is an example for us to do as well. But it's not mere example. This is not, Jesus is nice, now go out and be nice. If that were so, we could have anybody do this. Jesus is our substitute. He's our representative. What we see him doing here is loving his church to the end, to the perfection, to the consummation. We see him loving his Father to the end, to the perfection, to the consummation. And God counts Jesus' love as yours. The work that Jesus does here, this work of loving God with all his heart and all his soul and all his strength and all his mind, that work is credited to you when you turn your life over to him. The work of loving men like Judas perfectly is credited to you when you come to faith in Jesus Christ. Jesus is acting here as your substitute, doing what you and I will not do because we're so busy wanting to be gods. And more than that, in time, if you give your heart to him, if you give your life to him, what will happen is your life should already begin, if you have already done this, but it should and will continue to look more and more like this, not because you're following his example, but because he's living in you. So he begins to wash his feet, and he goes, or wash the disciples' feet, and he goes man by man. In verse 6, he comes finally to Simon Peter. And you know something's going to happen when he comes to Simon Peter. Lord, do you wash my feet? There's some incredulity here. Peter doesn't get what's going on at all. Kings don't wash feet. Messiahs don't wash feet. What's he doing? And you got to know, Peter's always known what's best for Jesus. He's always had a plan for Jesus' life. And Jesus is always not fulfilling that plan. And here is another case of Jesus being disobedient to Peter. Peter's not happy. And so Jesus responds, what I'm doing now, you don't understand, but afterward you will understand. What's he saying? I know you don't get what I'm doing. Trust me, Peter, and let me do this. Just let me do my work. Something that he says to us quite often, actually. Well, Peter's not happy, and Peter needs to rebuke Jesus and put him back where he belongs. And so in verse 8, Peter says, you'll never wash my feet. That's a declaration, but that's a declaration that is, in effect, a command. It's a command. You're not washing my feet. It is the most dangerous moment thus far in Peter's life and in our story. Far more dangerous than the betrayal of Judas. If you haven't caught on yet, Jesus isn't merely washing feet. Jesus' gospel is, has been, and still is, you are caught up in the mire and the dirt and the grime of your sin. And you cannot clean yourself. You cannot get away from it. You're caught. Turn to me and I will cleanse you. I'll make you new. I'll pull you from that mire. Israel's response has been typical, a typical human response. We see it articulated in several figures. In Mark's gospel, we see it through the figure of the rich young ruler who says to Jesus, all God's commands I've kept since I was a youth, so I don't need to be washed. In Luke's gospel, we see it in the Pharisee in the temple who thanks God that he's not like other men, that he's generous and he's honest and he's faithful and he's got integrity. But we see this attitude is not something that's exclusive to first century Jews. I'm going to read, I'll read it to you. This is a quote by Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City. If there's a God, he says, I'm not stopping to be interviewed after I die. I'm heading straight in. He means heaven, by the way. I'm heading straight in. I've earned my place in heaven. The context of his comment was his regulations about sugar and soft drinks or something. I don't know what it was, but that was it. I'm not stopping to be interviewed. I'm heading straight in. I've earned my place in heaven. Michael Bloomberg, the Pharisee in the temple, the rich young ruler, all of them give voice to the common human response to the gospel and to Jesus, which is, I don't need you to wash me, Jesus, because I'm clean. Maybe a little tweak here and there. Maybe you need to clean under the fingernails, but I'm basically clean. Or, and I think this is Peter's position, maybe I'm a little dirty, but you're not going to wash me. I'll wash myself. I'll wash myself. And now look at verse 8, because this is Jesus' response to Peter. This is Jesus' response to Michael Bloomberg. This is Jesus' response to you if you have this idea and this attitude in your heart. Jesus says, if I do not wash you, you have no share with me. Note here. Note the exclusivity. If I do not wash you, it's me, Jesus says, or nothing. I do the washing. Note also, this isn't something that we do together. It's not, hey, you know, I'm going to give you a bucket, I'm going to give you a sponge, and I'll give you some techniques for washing, and then go at it. We'll cooperate. No. If I do not wash you, you'll have no share with me. Christ alone is the one who washes. No one else. Nothing else. Every other religion, from Judaism to Buddhism to Hinduism, whatever it might be, every other religion hands you soap and a basin and says, get scrubbing. Here's the proper technique. Say these prayers. Walk in this way. Wear these special clothes. And once you do those things, you might, in fact, feel clean. But the truth is, as Jesus told the Pharisees, the fact is you've only cleaned the outside of the cup. Jesus alone cleans hearts. Jesus alone makes you clean. And the beautiful thing is that he kneels here in front of dirty, nasty, smelly men, the towel wrapped around his waist, ready to do so. He kneels here, ready to do so for you. But it requires relinquishing and surrendering all pretense, all thought in your mind or in your heart that you do not need him to do it, because you do, and so do I. Something, a light bulb goes on, a bell rings, something happens. Simon Peter gets it. Lord, not only my feet, but my hands and my head as well. Just give me a bath. Peter is not lukewarm. There's nothing about him that's halfway. Jesus responds, the one who's bathed doesn't need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean. Notice he's speaking to Peter. You are clean. Now, Peter, as we know, Peter has an obedience issue. Peter has a pride issue. Peter, as we're going to see, has a cowardice issue. He's going to deny Jesus. Jesus knows that. But Jesus says to Peter, you are clean. Why does he say that? Well, because despite all Peter's dirtiness, he gave his life to Jesus 2 years before this. He has already surrendered his heart to Christ. He's already feeding on the Lord's flesh and drinking his blood and his spirit. He's joined with Jesus as one. And so he's clean. And so are you if you've done that. You're clean. New Christians, after they're baptized, after they become believers, after they're beginning in their walk in Christ, sometimes ask or say, you know, I still do what I know I shouldn't be doing. And you know, the proper response is, welcome to the club, and welcome to the hospital. But it's a really worrisome thing. I still do what I know I shouldn't be doing. I still think what I shouldn't be thinking. I still watch what I shouldn't be watching. Am I really saved? Should I commit my life to Jesus again? Should I be rebaptized or something? It didn't seem to take. What do I need to do? And the answer to that question is found right here. No. You see, God sees all time at once. He saw you. He knew everything about you. He knew everything you would do and say and think before time began. And when he brought you to faith, when he brought Peter to faith, he took every single one of the sins that you have committed of thought, word, and deed, past, present, and future, and he placed them on his son on the cross, and he dealt with them there. He punished them there. So in his sight, regardless of what you've done today, regardless of what you did tomorrow, or you're going to do tomorrow, regardless of what you did yesterday, in his sight, you are clean because he has made you so. That's why when he died on the cross the next day, he says it's finished because it's finished. He's done it. And no matter what you do, you can't undo that. You're clean forever. Jesus says in John chapter 6, all that the Father gives to me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I'll never cast away. This is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he's given me, but raise it up at the last day. You're clean if you're in Christ. But what does Jesus mean here then when he says to Peter, hey, if you're already clean, only your feet need to be cleansed? I don't think that's too difficult either. Anne and I promised to remain married until one of us dies, and then the other one's free. I wouldn't say free. I'd say that'd be terribly tragic for her. My first, and me too. Just kidding. We promised to be married until we die. So that means, as you all know, if you're married, that I can do whatever I want, right? Because once I got the ring on her finger, that freed me up to be whoever I wanted to be and whatever I wanted to do. No, if you're married for an hour, you know that's not true. No married person thinks like that. We have committed ourselves to one another, and we're going to be married until one of us dies. But our relationship is about, and it should be about, not always is, but it should be about pouring ourselves out for one another, not because I'm afraid of her divorcing me or because she's afraid of me divorcing her, but because I want her good and she wants my good. And so what that means is that when I offend her, I need to say I'm sorry and ask forgiveness. And the same thing is true with you and God. He's brought you into a relationship of agape with himself, and so you're clean, but you still take little walks through the mud. You traipse through the mud every day, so do I. And so Jesus says, you're clean, but you still need to have your feet washed. That's what prayer is for. You go to Jesus every day and you offer him your feet again and again. You say, help me, Lord, make me clean every day. And this is what's beautiful about this text for believers here. Jesus' words here indicate to you and to me that he will never tire of washing your feet. You ever think sometimes, man, how many times have I asked forgiveness for this thing? I've done this thing so many times. Can he really still have patience with me? Yeah, yes. He wants to wash your stinking feet. It's amazing. How can I come to him with these thoughts in my head, this thing I keep doing, these things I keep watching? How can I even call myself a Christian? How can I let him wash me? And you can even come to the point where you're saying with Peter, you'll never wash my feet, but Jesus wants you to let him wash your feet. There's nothing to fear from him. You can expose the smelliest stuff about yourself doing. Nothing to fear whatsoever. No cause for shame. In fact, Jesus took that shame from you, and he bore that shame for you as he hung naked and shamed on the cross. So there's nothing that you can do, nothing that you have done, that will be a cause for shame in his eyes anymore. He's taken that. He'll never tire of washing your feet. You're his, and he loves you. Verse 10. But not every one of you, for he knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, not all of you are clean. There is, of course, still Judas. He allows, without objection, notice, he allows Jesus to wash his feet. So Judas's feet are clean, but his heart is hard. Jesus' words wash over Judas. He hears the offer and the promise and the instruction that he gives to Peter. Those words wash over Judas, but he refuses to let them seep in. Jesus knows this. He knows Judas. He's known him since the beginning, and still he serves him. Still he washes his feet. It could be more than just his feet. It could be, but Judas won't have it. And so Jesus does what he can do. He washes his feet. This is agape perfected. This is agape to the end. This is love without reciprocity, without need. But it is agape bathed in tragedy. And unfortunately, I do think it's a tragedy repeated every Sunday. Wherever Jesus' offer is heard and not received. If that's you, if you just kind of sit here on a Sunday morning or wherever on a Sunday morning and you hear over and over again, Jesus' offer, come to me, I'll make you clean, and you don't, you refuse. If that's you, you're not clean. But you can be. You can be. You don't have to follow Judas. You can offer your feet, you can offer your hands, you can offer your head, your heart, your whole self to the Lord. He will cleanse you and make you whole inside and out. Jesus will receive you and wash you and make you his forever. We are going to stop here.